Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, an Arizona perspective on the measles outbreak that's currently spreading through Texas and New Mexico, and a conversation with one of the most successful coaches in the history of Arizona high school basketball. But first, the phrase constitutional crisis is everywhere right now as experts and pundits try to parse whether or not we are headed toward or already in one. This as President Trump continues to bulldoze his way through his first months in office, shattering norms and pushing the limits of executive power. From trying to get rid of birthright citizenship, to revoking millions in federal funding, to allowing Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to fire federal workers en masse, it's been state attorneys general who have largely served as the backstop to the Trump administration's wishes in court, at least so far. Here in Arizona, Democratic Attorney General Chris Mayes has become a major voice of resistance as she files lawsuit after lawsuit to stop what she calls Trump's illegal actions. But does she think those lawsuits will serve as a true check on this administration's attempts to expand executive power, or does she think a constitutional crisis is on the horizon? My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
I genuinely believe that our country has never been in a more dangerous position than we are now, at least since the Civil War. And I don't say that lightly. As you know, I have called what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now with Elon Musk's infiltration of the Treasury Department and so many other agencies unlawfully. I call it a coup, because it is, and they continue to violate federal court orders. When we get court orders to stop Elon Musk and the president, they have violated those. That is a coup, and I deeply believe it's my job to stand up to it.
We are a state, though, that voted for Donald Trump in pretty big numbers in November. I wonder what you would say to folks who say, you know, this is what Arizonans voted for. This is what they want. Why are you kind of getting in the way?
So you are right that Arizona went for Trump. I do not believe that Arizonans, when they voted for Donald Trump, believed that they were getting a president who was going to shred the Constitution. I don't think Arizonans voted for chaos. I know Arizonans did not want to see the kinds of mass, indiscriminate firings of federal employees that we are seeing. I mean, they just fired firefighters across Arizona, including in Payson. Hotshots and support staff were fired right before fire season. We have seen a loss of critical services. The Grand Canyon, so many people were laid off at the Grand Canyon that we're hearing about wait times of 3 and 4 hours just to get into the canyon, not to mention the public safety aspects of that, plus the firefighters. We know that when Donald Trump engaged or tried to engage before I stopped him along with other AGs, in the federal funding freeze, they were going to defund our efforts to go after the Mexican drug cartels and stop fentanyl from coming across the border. And so, no, I do not believe Arizonans voted for all of that. And I think we're starting to see that. We certainly have seen it here in my office in the form of, you know, hundreds of phone calls into my office from Arizonans objecting to what President Trump is doing.
So then let's talk about maybe what is the phrase of the month or the week or whatever it may be, which is constitutional crisis, right? Like, you have filed lawsuit after lawsuit, joined on to lawsuit after lawsuit, challenging these actions by the Trump administration. But a lot of folks are concerned that this administration will not respect the will of the courts. It seems like they have so far largely complied with those decisions. But do you think this kind of constitutional crisis is where we're headed?
So, unfortunately, I think we are, and I think we actually already are at that point, which is why I continue to call it a coup. They have violated at least one, if not more, of the TROs. Trump was already found guilty of violating our federal funding freeze TRO. We had to go back, as you know, to get essentially a contempt motion, a motion to compel against President Trump and Elon Musk in that case. So we are at that point. I mean, that is a crisis when a president violates a federal judge's order, when a president starts saying things like, maybe we need to look at the judges, when you have people in the administration like J.D. Vance, who made the stunning claim that judges don't have the power to check executive overreach. That is an outright attack on the checks and balances that are enshrined in our Constitution. It is an authoritarian mindset. It is dictatorial and it is dangerous. This is why our country was formed, Lauren. And so, yeah, we have already seen the president step over that line. And you know, we will continue to look at our options. The AGs talk about this almost every day, Lauren. We
Right.
have a
So tell me what
call.
that means for not just you, but for AGs in general, the role that you outlined there. Like, what does it mean for states' rights?
Well, you know, I mean, I think states are going to have to come to terms with this, and we are looking at our options. And so that's the conversation that we are having. At the end of the day, many of these cases will land on the desks of the members of the United States Supreme Court, and they are going to have to decide whether or not we still have a country. They are going to have to decide whether or not they still support the Constitution, the separation of powers, the appointments clause, and whether or not they still support our form of government. And that is literally where this is headed.
Let me ask you a question or two about the political side of this before I let you go. We're seeing other Democrats in our state and around the country move maybe more to the center as the Trump administration has come into power in light of the kind of political reality of what voters chose last year. You seem to be taking a different approach. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I guess I would disagree. I think it's pretty centrist to support the Constitution. Frankly, there's a whole lot of Republicans, and Lauren, as you know, I used to be one, who still believe in the Constitution, who still believe in the separation of powers. So, look, I'm maybe going back to my roots as someone who loves the Constitution and loves this country. And I know Democrats do too, and so do independents. This is about the rule of law and standing up for the rule of law. And, you know, I don't want to look back on my life and not know and believe that I did everything in my power to protect Arizonans and our Constitution.
Do you worry about risking critical federal funding to Arizona by challenging the administration in this way?
Well, we're already losing a lot of critical federal funding and at risk of that if we don't win these court orders. And I've saved, and along with the other AGs, I saved Arizona hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars by fighting back against the federal funding freeze and getting a TRO against it. I don't think sitting back and sitting on our hands is an option at this point. We would lose so much more if we weren't fighting for our Constitution and fighting back against these unconstitutional executive orders that are flying out of the White House every day.
We'll leave it there for now. Much more to come, I'm sure. That is Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mayes joining us. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Lauren.
Well, speaking of impending crises, there's been increasing anxiety over the last several weeks about an outbreak of measles in Texas and New Mexico. In Texas alone, there have been over 120 cases confirmed, the most the state has seen in the last 3 decades. And the situation took on greater urgency yesterday as Texas officials announced the death of a child from the illness, the first measles-related fatality in the U.S. in 10 years, and the first death of a child since 2003. That low fatality rate is largely thanks, I should say that low historical fatality rate, is largely thanks to the highly effective measles vaccine, which prevents the disease. But with vaccine skepticism on the rise, and prominent vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now leading the Department of Health and Human Services, there is widespread concern that many families will not take the necessary steps to protect their kids. The child who died from measles was reportedly unvaccinated. Secretary Kennedy created some confusion yesterday by calling the outbreak not unusual, and he also claimed that there have been two deaths, which news outlets could not immediately confirm. Meanwhile, public health officials in the Southwest are sounding the alarm, including Will Humble, the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association, who joins us now in studio. Good morning, Will.
Morning. Thanks.
So, Will, you are not just the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. You are, if I'm not mistaken, a measles survivor.
That's right. So I grew up in Tucson, and I actually was exposed to measles in 1961. My mom knew that I had a play date with somebody named Allison Vitale down there, and she knew that Allison Vitale had she was diagnosed with measles before I was symptomatic. And she took me down, and she said she got a very expensive shot of gamma globulin, which is all there really was in those days. It's some antibodies that you can take that sort of take the edge off. So if you get the disease, and sure enough, I ended up getting measles. She said I had a 106 degree fever. She was really scared. And I recovered because I'm here, but
yes, and thank goodness for that. But your mom was contact tracing before it was cool.
That's what exactly she was doing. That's right. She was contact tracing. She knew Allison had it. She knew I was exposed. She knew it was really contagious. She knew how serious it was because the vaccine didn't come out till 63. So this was a scary illness in those days for parents because it does kill 1 out of 300 kids, and 1 out of 20 get a serious case of pneumonia.
Yeah. Well, so just to give folks an idea of how scary this is, it's not just that the symptoms are really intense, as you were just alluding to. It's not just that the potential of fatality is very high. The contagiousness of measles is also extreme. Can you give us an example?
Yeah, it's super contagious. I mean, a lot of epis think it's the most contagious disease there is. For example, I'm here in the studio. I was in the elevator a half hour ago. I'm gonna leave the studio in a bit. And if I had had measles, somebody taking that elevator 2 hours from now would have enough of an exposure to contract the disease. It hardly takes any virus to infect the next person. So yeah, super contagious.
So you have used in a blog post about this, you have used the metaphor of a wildfire to describe this situation and that we need to try to contain it as we would a wildfire. What does that mean to you?
Yeah. So like when you have a wildfire, it's really important, especially when we have red flag days and stuff like it's coming up in June. You got to have like the hotshots get in there when it's just an acre or two in size because it can grow really, really fast. Same thing with measles. If measles is in an environment with low vaccination rates, like is the case in West Texas, like we have in Yavapai and Mojave counties, and you have an initial what we call index case, and that type of red flag environment, it can spread really, really fast. So the hot shot that goes to the firefighter, that goes to that initial wildfire, is analogous to a clinician in a clinic at a community health center, at a pediatric office, who needs to recognize that very first measles case and turn it into the county health department so they can get out and do the contact tracing, to do the isolation and quarantine, to exclude kids from that were exposed from the classroom for 2 incubation periods. Because if you don't get it right away, it starts to really spread quickly if it's in an area with low vaccination rates. I mean, we've got parts of Arizona with great vaccination rates. The measles, for example, the Yuma area, the Pima County area, Santa mm-hmm. Cruz County, good vaccination rates. And then we have places that have horrible vaccination rate, Yavapai County, Mojave County. So if the virus gets into a place like, you know, Chino Valley, then you're not able to find that initial case really fast, it mushrooms like is currently happening in Texas.
Yeah. Well, so what are you hearing from your contacts throughout the state about how folks in those less vaccinated areas are responding to this?
I don't know. I doubt that there's an influx of parents going to get their kids vaccinated because the threat in West Texas seems so remote. And to be true, like if this was Las Vegas, if this outbreak was like in a place like Las Vegas or either in Southern California, we'd be at higher risk because there's a lot more personal traffic back and forth.
Right.
I don't know how much traffic there is between, you know, rural Arizona or Arizona in general and West Texas, not as much as you just see from, you know, closer places like
sure.
LA.
Sure. Well, just about a minute left here, Will. You know, we were alluding to the fact that there has been some potentially unreliable information coming out at the federal level about this. For folks who are concerned about that, where would you suggest they turn for reliable information?
It's simple. Your pediatrician. That's it. I mean,
okay.
You don't have to turn to me. Don't turn to a county health department. Talk to your pediatrician, the person who sees your kids at the community health center. Spend time with them. That's the place to go. And study after study show that the people that are trusted the most in situations like this aren't Will Humble on the radio, but rather the clinician, your pediatrician, your pediatric provider. That's the place.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for today. Will Humble is a measles survivor and the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Thank you, Will.
My pleasure.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a man who has dedicated his life to using a letterpress printer.
Setting something you wrote one letter at a time by hand. Big difference between that and thumb typing on a smartphone. I don't do anything with portable electronic devices. I'll have none of that. I'm that old fashioned. I belong in 1925.
We'll hear from the owner of Skyline Type Foundry, who is passionate about the esoteric craft of type founding. But first, an eventful season for the Seton Catholic Preparatory High School girls basketball team recently ended. Its coach, Karen Self, became the winningest coach in state girls basketball history, more than 830 wins over three decades at the school. Self played basketball at ASU and says she pretty much always knew she wanted to get into coaching. After college, she was working at a YWCA. When she applied for the coaching job at Seton, she was 23 when she started her first season there. Now, in addition to her regular coaching job, she'll be an assistant coach later this spring at the Nike Hoops Summit, a joint venture between USA Basketball and Nike in Portland, Oregon, in which the best high school players in the U.S. take on those from the rest of the world. My co-host, Mark Brody, recently sat down with Self at Seton Prep, and they started with what the 23-year-old Karen Self would think about the fact that she's still there and has won more games doing this than anyone else in Arizona history.
I don't think that young Karen would ever have imagined that or would even believe it because I tend to be a little more on the shy side and fairly insecure, and so I definitely would not believe that about myself.
Does current Karen believe it?
At times, I guess, but it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard to kind of like think about like a 30-year career or 30-year plus career and put that into perspective. And so right now, I'm trying to just get my team ready for the playoffs and kind of prepare us for what's coming next. And then I think maybe as the season comes to a conclusion, then I'll start to maybe reflect on that.
Were you able to enjoy it when it happened? And I ask because, as you just referenced, you hear so many athletes or coaches saying, you know, they have these amazing milestones, but they're not really able to appreciate it in the moment because there's another game to prepare for or another game that day to win. Like, have you been able to reflect on it at all?
So my assistant coach, Kayla Reffner, she actually played for me here, and she did a really, really great job of trying to keep me calm and help me put things in perspective and help me enjoy it because I was dreading it. I was absolutely dreading it going into the season. I was worried that my players would feel a lot of pressure, and I did not want them to feel like we have to win this game because Karen has this milestone. Like, I never wanted that to be on their minds at all. truth be told, I'd rather that they didn't know it existed. But that was going to be impossible given this milestone. But yeah, Kayla did a great job helping me. My husband did a great job helping me. And actually, I did really enjoyed it. Once it was there and it was over and we had the celebration a few days later, it was really amazing and wonderful.
How would you say that your coaching style has evolved over the time you've been doing this?
Well, honestly, when I first started, I had actually no idea what I was doing. I just drew on my college coach.
Because you played for 4 years at ASU.
I did. And I played for Maura McHugh, and she was a fantastic coach, and especially like her practice plans and just the level of detail that she put into like what did we need to work on. And so I drew a lot from that as much as I could. But it took me a few years to really kind of start to figure it out. And then I started to realize like the more I can learn, you know, the better the outcome for our team. And so I started attending every coach's clinic that I could possibly attend and just get my hands on any little nuggets of information that would help my team, help with motivation, help my knowledge. And so, like, I feel like I've learned a lot over the years. I feel like becoming a mom, like, helped me become more patient with my players. It's not to say I don't have moments of overly excited coaching, but yeah, like I definitely think it helped me be more patient, helped me understand their kids' perspective a little bit better when my children participated in sports. So yeah, I mean, I feel like I think about things a lot more in more detail, like how can I break things down, and just trying to put those relationships with my players first and like let the wins be a byproduct of that.
Well, see, I'm curious about that. Like, how much of what you try to do is about X's and O's and drawing up plays and things like that? And how much of it is relating to your players and sort of understanding maybe what's going on in their lives and almost being like a psychologist a little bit?
Well, I mean, it's very hard for me this year because our players are so young. But I think that the younger ones can see the relationships that we have with our seniors, and they can see, like, there's a much more casual friendship and give and take in that way versus when they're freshmen, they come in and they're very scared and they're just like, oh, this, you know, coach, and she, you know, I mean, they've obviously heard like, oh, she's won a lot of games or whatever. And so I think, you know, and I am very intense on the sideline. So I think for them, it takes time to kind of break down that fear and let them know that, like, we really do care about you guys as people more than we care about you as basketball players. And when you can kind of cross that threshold and get to that point with a kid, then you can really help them achieve anything in basketball.
What is it about basketball specifically that appeals to you so much?
That is a great question. I'm not sure I know. I love to compete. I've played basketball my whole life. It's always been a part of like who I am. I'm very comfortable with a ball in my hands. in fact, when young Karen was coaching, her players pointed out that I couldn't address the team if I didn't have a ball in my hands.
Really?
Yeah, I'm very insecure. And so, especially when I was younger, I would say, hey, let me see that ball. And I never realized that's what I was doing. But one of my players was like, you know that every time you want to talk to us in a group, you always ask to have a ball in your hands? And I was like, wow, is it like my little security blanket? so yeah, it's just like always been a part of my life. And yeah, I mean, I think really my passion is coaching. I'm just better at like basketball because I know it better.
I know that you've probably been asked this a bazillion times, but how much longer do you want to keep doing this?
I know, everybody asks me that. So honestly, like as long as it's still fun, as long as I'm still enjoying it, and I mean, I really do love the kids and I love coaching. And this year has been really refreshing because there's been so much teaching that has gone on for our really young, inexperienced team. But honestly, like if you could have seen us in June and then you saw us in October and then you saw us today, you would not believe that's the same team at all. And so that progress and that growth for those kids is literally a driving factor for me. And so kind of getting back to my roots and like really teaching the very basics of the game has actually been really fun.
I would think that'd be fairly gratifying.
Very gratifying.
Do you have like a number of wins that you are aiming for? Like, let's say you get to 1,000. Okay, I've hit 4 digits. I'm good. I can walk away happy.
I don't. I definitely do not have a number in mind. I'm just kind of like, I do feel like I have the passion and the energy and the enjoyment to keep going. I always said when I was younger, I'm not going to be some 50-year-old, you know, old lady like coaching these players. Well, here I am at 55 and I am still having the time of my life. So, you know, in my head, I think 65 so in my head, I think, 10 or 12 more years, but like, really it's going to be determined by like, am I enjoying it? And is it fun?
Sure. I'm curious, like what it says to you that you have, your whole career has been here. Yeah. Like, you have all these wins, all these players, all these games at one school. It's not like you've been at multiple places.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had the opportunity to go on and go to other places, but this is a really great community. And, you know, I didn't always make the best decisions as a coach when I was younger, and they stuck with me, and they saw me through, like, hard times. They've seen me. I mean, I was still dating my husband when I started, like, my marriage, my children, births and deaths and everything in between. This community has been here to support me. And I always say, like, I could never give to Seton what they have given to me. Like, I could never match what I've received from the community here. And that's kind of like what Seton prides itself on, is just being like a family feel. Right in here in the middle of suburbia, we have this very, very small town feel. And so that community means the world to me. And so I just can't see myself coaching anywhere else.
So let me ask you about, you're going to be doing some work with USA Basketball coming up. You seem pretty excited about that.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you be? I mean, it's USA Basketball. I mean, it's kind of like a dream come true for me. I mean, you know, as a player, I was skilled and talented, and I had an opportunity to play in college for free, and I didn't have to pay for my education, and that was great. But I was always just shy of that USA Basketball level. And I think, like, as a coach, having the opportunity to work with USA Basketball in any capacity is a dream come true for me.
All right, that is Coach Karen Self with Seton Catholic Preparatory High School. Coach, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. The Phoenix food world may have lost an institution yesterday. Durant's Steakhouse, a 75-year-old fixture in the city's food scene, announced a temporary closure in the wake of a sale to new ownership. The restaurant isn't being shut down. It's actually been acquired by a family that owns other steakhouses, and the new owners are promising a, quote, renaissance for Durant's. But was there anything wrong with the old version? Joining us now to remember the Durant's that was is KJZZ contributor Robert Pala. Good morning, Robert.
Hey, Sam.
So, Robert, off the air, you told me that the closing of Durant's is one of those news events where you're always going to remember where you were when you found out about it.
Right.
So my first question is, where were you?
I was doing laundry, and I got a text from my friend. I mean, this gives you an idea of how, for many of us, this was an important moment in time. I got a text from my friend Kimberly Baker, who's a foodie and a former restaurant owner, and she grew up in Phoenix, but she lives in Ohio. She's been in Ohio for years. And she texted me and said, "What's going on? What is this? And, and I'm like, "You're in Ohio and this is shaking you up." And it probably should, because it was a big deal for us.
Yeah. Yeah. But the kind of existential tone of just the words in that also evokes the associations people seem to have with this place.
Right.
I am a Johnny come lately to Phoenix. I haven't even lived here a year yet, so I unfortunately never got to go to Durant's. For people like me, we have a lot of Johnny-come-latelys in Phoenix. Mm. Tell us what was really special about it. What set it apart?
So, you know, Durant's had the restaurant opened in 1950. It had a very specific old-school steakhouse vibe, but it was not campy. It wasn't kitschy. It wasn't, let's try to look like 1957. It wasn't that at all. It was just that it had never changed, right? And so it had a shtick, but it was not manipulative. It wasn't like, look at how goofy we are, pretending right. like it's 1963. They weren't.
Yeah.
The red-flocked walls were there because that was what Durant's looked like. And you entered through the kitchen because that was what you did.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and there, you know, like a lot of things that stick around, there's a cult around it. We all collected these dessert chips. They look like poker chips. They have the Durant's logo on them. They're issued once a year on the anniversary of the restaurant. And people, like, book weeks in advance to make sure that they're there that night so that they can get the new dessert chip. You only need one. It's not like they expire. And I mean, it became part of the landscape in the way that old restaurants do.
Yeah.
But in this case, what was special is there was never a point in the 70s or in the 80s where someone came in and said, we got to update this place. We got to make it look like 1983.
Right. It never became like an imitation of itself, it sounds right. like. It always just was what it was.
Right. It wasn't retro.
Yeah. Well, and steakhouse culture is such a thing in people's minds. You know, there's like national chains that are kind of trying to evoke what it sounds like Durant's really was. If I'm not mistaken, you know, one of the things we think about in like steakhouse lore is like mob affiliations. Like, was there a hit there? Was there not?
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, Durant's had like a real mob connection, right?
Yes. So Jack Durant, who opened the place in 1950, was a small-time gangster. I mean, you know, very small-time, but he sure. did hang out with the big guys.
Yeah.
And when they came to Phoenix, they would stay with him at his house on Central Avenue, and they would dine at Durant's. The part of the lore, and this is just coming to me now, is, you know, Don Bowles, the journalist who was murdered at the Clarendon Hotel mm-hmm. in the 70s, the story has long been that the meetings that behind planning that murder took place at Durant's. I mean, who knows, right?
Right, right.
But that's the kind of place it was.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that keeps a sense of authenticity flowing through a place.
Yeah.
This shutdown, supposedly temporary transition to new ownership, this is the kind of thing that we're seeing a lot of here in the Valley, right? There's a lot of longstanding institutions that the name is being preserved, but new owners are kind of making changes. How do you see this as in dialogue with the rest of those?
I hope that it is distinct from that. I know what you're talking about. You mean the fact that the Circles Records building, which was a Studebaker yes. Mm-hmm. A showroom in the 50s, is now largely preserved as the lobby of a skyscraper, and there's a restaurant there. It was recently announced that the Punch Card building, the Phoenix Financial Center high-rise, is going to no longer be an office building, but rather condominiums and a hotel. Cities need to change, right? We can't be scrapbooks for ourselves. We have to evolve with the time. So those are good things. Sky Harbor no longer needed two little tiny, out of date, largely useless places to grab a plane, and so now we have two great big ones. Right. We need to evolve. I think Durant's does not need to evolve. I think what I'm hoping for is that everything will stay the same. The red flocked wallpaper and the menu. The food until a couple of years ago was really quite good.
Yeah. Well, we know that the folks who are taking it over are also in the steakhouse business, so we'll have to see. But I guess I'm wondering, we have just about 30 seconds left here.
Yeah.
If you are the kind of person who used to love to have a martini at Durant's, watch the sunset, where would you recommend people go now to get a similar old Phoenix experience and perhaps toast the demise of Durant's?
Maybe the Stockyards or, I don't know, Alexi or El Choro Lodge. There's a place on East Thomas Road called Avanti, which is very groovy in a 70s way. You know, I talked to the food writer Dominic Armato about this yesterday, and he said the thing that they can do right is not to mess it up. And I think that kind of sums it up. The new owners probably need to stick with the Durant's vibe, or we're not going to be happy about it.
Well, that is KJZZ contributor Robert Pala raising a virtual toast to Durant's. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks, Sam.
Good morning and welcome back one more time to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. And today, to close out, we continue our analogs series about people who make things by hand and what those things tell us about those people.
We figure it's about 80, 90 years old.
Even though the technology is so rudimentary, you can have a lot more control.
It has lately, in the last 15 years, turned into more of a passion type of thing.
I needed an escape.
On a warm Tuesday last May, I drove up to Prescott and parked my car outside a small compound of low-slung buildings on top of a hill. It was early afternoon, and there was a mist drifting through the valley below. Above the door of one of the buildings was a sign. It said, Chapel.
Ah, yes. Like everything else, therein lies a tale.
This is Sky Shipley, the owner of the Skyline Type Foundry.
I got to referring to this building as the chapel because Type Foundry is practically a religion for us. It's the perfect name for this place. It's mysterious, it's true, and it's memorable.
In the world of printing and letterpress, Sky Shipley is something of a folk hero.
There is no other place on Earth that you can get the type that we are creating here.
Most of us think of typefaces as the shape of words on a page. You open Microsoft Word or Google Docs, you pick one from a drop-down menu, and you start typing. I wrote the script for this story in Times New Roman, a typeface that almost anyone who's ever typed a document would probably recognize. But once upon a time, each Times New Roman letter in this script would have physically existed. And the journey of those letters to this page would have started at a place like Skyline Type Foundry. To print with Times New Roman letters, you would have first needed a Times New Roman matrix. You can think of the matrix sort of like a bread mold, or maybe a collection of small molds, each of them in the shape of a single character. At the chapel, Sky Shipley has one of the original Times New Roman matrices, which he uses to make Times New Roman type. The type comes in a little box. When you open it, you find rows of tiny hunks of metal, little loaves of letter bread. Each metal loaf is etched with a single character in the Times New Roman style. Each of those tiny etched characters has been cast, or baked, to overwork this metaphor, using a 1930s typecasting machine. All of which is to say, there was a time when a font was not a casual choice. And Sky Shipley has dedicated his life to honoring that time.
Oh, Sam, there is a big, big difference between setting something you wrote one letter at a time by hand. Big difference between that and thumb typing on a smartphone. I don't do anything with portable electronic devices. I'll have none of that. I'm that old-fashioned. I belong in 1925. And I'm going to go to the grave that way.
For decades now, Sky has been collecting typeface matrices from all over the world. He showed me one he'd recently rescued from an old foundry in India. He has hundreds of these matrices, some more than a century old. When he finds them, he brings them here to the chapel, where they're cast by one of Sky's employees, a guy named Jared.
I find a lot of satisfaction here because it's something that not everyone has done in their life. And I think, don't quote me on this, even though I am being recorded, but I think I am the last person in at least America who has the job position of typecaster because we're the last full-time type foundry.
To be clear, while Skyline carries common typefaces like Times New Roman, they also cast incredibly rare ones.
So this is Collier right here. And it was a specific design for a specific magazine.
That magazine, by the way, was called Collier's. It was published from 1888 to 1957.
And there was only one set of those matrices cut, because some fonts, the really popular ones, have had multiple matrices cut so they can be made by many. But there was only one set of these matrices cut. And so we were able to get the one, and we're able to now give that type to anybody who wants it, kind of thing.
Jared is the guy who operates that machine from the 1930s that I mentioned earlier. There are four of these machines at Skyline Type Foundry. They look sort of like a cross between a wood stove and an oil rig. To cast a piece of type, say a letter H, Jared fills a basin with molten liquid, an alloy of lead, tin, and antimony. He fires up a primitive motor and feeds the H mold into a pumping, wheezing forest of cranks, wheels, levers, and hoses. The alloy hardens and gets pressed into the form of an H, and then a tiny metal plate with an H on it shoots out the side of the machine.
Good here. Just gonna check that off, check that off. Gonna do this one more time.
Sky told me that most font boxes come with four capital H's. So if Jared's doing a run of 150 boxes of a particular typeface, that means he has to cast 600 H's, which, of course, is just one character. An average typeface contains 72 characters. Jared says each font takes him about a week to cast.
It's a little bit of a complex process, but Sky got it all figured out, so everything is seamless, and that's the cool part, is that it works.
A moment later, Jared corrected himself. The process isn't totally seamless, but that's not really Skyline's fault. Those four casting machines they use are the last of their kind. If they break, which they sometimes do, the only person who knows how to fix them is Sky. But there's only so much he can do because nobody's making parts for them anymore.
Every time we lose one of those parts, it's gone for good, basically. Another reason why I have to pay very, very, very close attention to what I'm doing and make sure that I'm not making a mistake in any meaningful way.
Sky's collection of typeface matrices is also the only one of its kind. And many of the typefaces in Sky's collection are the only known copies. If they get lost or damaged, that typeface goes extinct. It's a responsibility that Sky takes seriously. He's not a young man. He opened the foundry back in 2011, when he retired after 27 years as a pilot. But he's working even harder now than he did then. The day we met, he'd just gotten back from California. A family there had called to say their grandfather had an old press and some typefaces. So Sky made three trips there and back to haul everything up to the chapel. He and Jared start work every day at 6 a.m. They add 2 to 3 new typefaces to their catalog every month. When Sky told me that casting type means working with lead, I asked if that ever makes him nervous. He said he doesn't worry about it, that they don't heat the alloy hot enough to toxify the lead. And either way, they work in a shop with plenty of ventilation. He told me people, like me, ask him about this a lot. And when they do, he has a joke he likes to tell.
Have you ever heard of the occupational disease associated with printing and type founding? Not counting alcoholism, I mean. And they say, well, no. I say, because there is none. There is no occupational hazard from working with lead if you don't eat it.
Even if it's just the typefaces that are in danger, the question of life and death feels relevant, given the nature of Sky's work.
I wonder if anyone will take the torch and go with it after I have to step out. Probably not. I don't think it will survive me. It would be a life commitment. It would change your life, for sure, to take on this business. It would be your life.
For the moment, though, there's not really time to think about stuff like that. Sky and Jared have too much work to do. And towards the end of my visit, I wanted to make sure they knew that I appreciated them letting me distract them with my questions.
Jared, can I... What's your last name?
Why do you need that? Sorry.
Just so I could properly identify you in the story. You don't have to share if you don't want to.
Well, I just... I prefer the concept of I am playing a vital part in a 500-year-old craft. And I am keeping something alive, which is supposed to stay alive, in my opinion. And so it's not really, don't shout it from the rooftops kind of thing, so.
Jared's words had a kind of mystical ring to them, which was fitting, given the existential energies that seemed to linger in the air around the chapel. Then again, maybe that was just the mist drifting up from the valley. Or maybe not. Maybe that uncertainty is ultimately what matters.
One of the other things I was really interested in on your website is that you said one of the things you're committed to is the mystery of this process. What's the appeal of the mystery?
Well, we've got a bunch of liquid metal here. We got a brass matrix and a machine. Combine all those three and we get type. To me, that's a mystery. It's mechanically explainable, but it's still a mystery.
As I was packing up to leave Skyline Type Foundry, Jared stopped by Sky's office to chat about their schedule for the next day. When they were finished, Jared turned to me. He handed me a small rectangle of cardstock.
And for you, Sam, this is a piece of letterpress art I made, which would be a nice little souvenir for you.
Printed on the card, in one of the Foundry's typefaces, was a phrase, "We are what we fight for."
That's a quote that I heard once and thought very deeply about it for a long time. That's a cool part of letterpress art, is that it's both a message and a beauty.
Special thanks this week to John Rasu. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.